I want to welcome Finn McAsee to the studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
Finn's here to talk permaculture, as we do every few weeks, slightly different day this time. Finn is a permaculturist, and are you available for hire for do some permaculture design, just out of curiosity?
Yeah. Particularly, yeah. I guess, the more local, the more motivated and interested I am.
Well, that is part of permaculture. Yeah. Localism is a part of it. But what we've been talking about, and we're going to continue to talk about, are the design principles that David Holmgren devised in early 2000s, very early 2000s. And today's design principle is, I scribbled it, design from patterns to detail.
Perfect.
There we go. Yeah, I wrote it really badly. but you were just saying to me before we went on the air that this is like a second part of the design principles, there's something significant about the how you approach them.
Yeah, there is. So there's the 12 principles, and the first six are really looking kind of almost bottom up. So they're from the, I guess, the thinking about design from the perspective of like an organism, an element, or an individual. And the second set that we're going to explore for the next, you know, several chats is looking at from a top-down perspective, so looking almost like at a systems level, designing systems. So designing from pattern to detail. So nature always designs from the pattern, never from the detail. And so one of the things, just to make an example of that, is what I'll often get in, you know, kind of permaculture design is some version of, I want an avocado tree, where should it go? And that is designing from a detail, trying to understand the pattern. And, you know, that's just one kind of silly example, but you can imagine we do that all the time.
But you may decide world. You may decide you definitely want avocados, though.
No, that's fine. But then you need to find a pattern, and you start from the pattern, and then eventually you'll determine whether an avocado is actually suitable or not.
Right, okay. So, yeah. You might say, no, this is Antarctica. An avocado tree is not going to fly.
Yeah, or even potentially, and you know, whited tuna.
And I'm being said, okay, you're comparing whited tuna to Antarctica?
No. what I am looking at there is frost susceptibility. Primarily.
Right, okay.
Yeah, so again, you know, and an avocado, you know, isn't an unreasonable example, although there are increasingly frost-hardy avocados available. But in general terms, you know, people have expectations about being able to grow whatever they want, wherever they want. And, you know, even in my journey here, moving from a warmer bioregion to down in Whangaroa, there's stuff that I used to grow quite a lot and had a desire and expectation to be able to grow here. And my site is not yet suitable for growing those things. And so I lost plants.
So where were you? I thought you were sort of Auckland area.
Yeah.
So it's not really that far.
No, but even the amount of climatic change is enough where...
Is that a latitude thing, or is there more to it?
There's a little bit more to it, but some of it's site features as well. So, for example, you know, like our site is quite currently prone to frost, mainly because we don't have any tree cover. So there's no protection. There's no frost protection on my site. So even the frosts we do get set much harder.
Okay, all right.
So it used to frost at our place further up in Tamaki, but we had, you know, a sun trap, and we had a reasonable amount of shade cover, so the frosts were quite light, relatively.
Something I noticed with the bearish frost we had in town this year was that the grass frosted, but as you got into the ground, the frost stopped. Mm. Like the ground was too warm for the frost to stick to the ground.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, that's a barely viable frost.
Yeah.
I would have said.
And that's what we noticed on our side is, you know, so again, this is that kind of pattern observation.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's frost, but then there's a light frost and a deep frost, and they're quite different in terms of the effects they have on your site, particularly around, you know, what might tolerate a light frost and what might die and keel over.
So you just used the word observation there, and I know that I think one of the things you do is you're trying to observe your site for a long time, and that, I guess, that's how you figure out what those patterns are.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I guess there's this other... So we talked a lot about design in the past as well. And, you know, this principle is the first one to talk explicitly about design from pattern to detail. But part of design is about pattern recognition. You know, the ability to notice different patterns that are forming. And so this is not unique to permaculture, but one of the things, you know, we learn, I guess, from ecological literacy, from the ability to look at nature and start to see patterns form, is then we can start replicating some of those patterns. And so, you know, one of the earliest explorations in permaculture was essentially, how do we take, how do we look at agriculture, land use, and ecology, and bring them all together?
Yeah.
And then they kind of thought, well, how does nature do it? And they went, well, let's look at forests. You know, forests are able to provide all of those things. They provide all the ecosystem functions or all the ecosystem services that everything in that community of life needs. They provide food for all of those things. And they do that in a way where it provides habitat for all the living things in it. And so can we replicate...
And with no human... assistance.
Well, not necessarily. Yeah.
So I always find
that it depends on the forest systems, but in many of our forest systems, like many parts of the Amazon, for example, which we think of like the last great wilderness, humans are most often keystone species in Amazonian forests.
Okay. That's true. I think what I'm kind of always drawn to, I always want to remember, is like, because we see when we run our farms in the modern world, it's very intensive. A lot of effort is put in to get the stuff to happen.
Mm.
And permaculture kind of reminds me that it doesn't have to be quite like that.
Yeah, well, it's not.
I mean, it might be, but the natural world is able to run itself.
So another example there that I think is probably quite good, and this may be controversial, but if we look at the pattern language of Aotearoa as a whole, and certainly of almost all of the Waikato, it's a forest. So the pattern language is a forest, which suggests that when given any opportunity, our landscapes are always going to try to revert to forest systems.
Yeah.
That's the pattern language. So trying to enforce grasslands is going to be hard work because that's not the natural. We have enough rainfall that things are going to tend towards perennial systems, and they're going to organize into complex systems called forests.
Yeah.
And right now, you know, with all the assembly of plants we have, they're not going to necessarily look like a historic native forest, but they're still going to tend towards a forest ecology, and they're going to assemble themselves based on a whole range of kind of almost universal patterns associated with forests. And so thinking about that is, if we're wanting to grow food, then maybe how do we replicate forests as opposed to something more like grasslands? And, you know, I'm not saying we shouldn't have any paddocks and we should, you know, abolish our dairy or our beef or whatever else, but the working hard part that you're speaking to often is a reference to the effort, energy, time required to try to enforce a pattern onto a system.
You'll fight against the existing pattern.
Yeah.
And keep it suppressed.
That's right. And so people hate gorse because it interrupts the... you know, because we have a focus on what a paddock should look like, what a grassland system should look like.
Also,
and gorse is really good at trying to reestablish a forest.
It's also very sharp.
Yeah. Oh, they're prickly.
Yeah. Sometimes it feels personal with gorse. It kind of does. I think some early experience imprinted on my brain there, negative gorse experience.
Yep.
But yeah, well, gorse is universally seen as a pest in the seeds last 50 years. And
I don't think that's true.
Culturally, in my personal culture, my experience of until I met permaculturists, and I met Joe Palaisha saying gorse is great, it's a resource, right?
Yeah, that was the first time. To turn his degraded paddocks into forest gardens.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, more realistically, gorse is like does it create a nursery environment?
It does. It's an awesome nursery plant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in fact, there's an area, I remember talking with Liz Stanway about this, about the hills around Nomai Business Park.
Mm-hmm.
Used to be a lot of gorse. We'll remember when I had an interview with one day, and there used to be a lot of gorse, and now there's bigger trees coming up through it.
Yep.
And eventually they will shade out the gorse, won't they?
Yeah, gorse always stays to the edges. It's an edge dweller. Once it's done its job in creating the conditions for that secondary forest growth to come through, it's no longer, that's not its niche.
And as far as it's concerned, a grass paddock is one great big edge.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah, okay.
Forest waiting to reestablish itself.
Okay. Sometimes we get carried away with the detail, but this is kind of important to understand.
But the pattern here, we are talking about patterns.
Yeah, yeah. And how strong that is, that pattern. And if there wasn't, I mean, gorse is particularly hardy and prickly, but there's always been plants like...
Well, and this is really interesting. So we're talking about the pattern.
Before Gorse was here, there were other plants that did
exactly
that job.
Right. So Gorse is a detail, I guess, in this kind of context.
Yeah.
And if it wasn't Gorse, it would be something else. Gorse just seems to be, to my mind, more effective at restarting a forest ecology than a lot of other things.
Mm.
And there's exotics and natives that all do this, that still provide that role.
It's kind of bracken will pop up.
Bracken is the primary initial colonizer in disturbed land.
And often, in fact, if you clear your gorse, it's the bracken that will straight up.
That will come up next. Yeah. And again, Māori knew that and used that edge quite well. So there's this idea that Christopher Alexander popularized. He was an architect of the last century, who I'm sure you know.
Yeah, pattern language I know about, yeah.
So he talked about this idea of pattern language, and mostly he was interested as an architect in built form. But he went around the world and he noticed that there was kind of pattern languages that a lot of traditional cultures picked up on, and they had kind of almost this universal quality. But you go to different settlements all around the world and you notice that they'd use similar principles. They'd identify similar patterns of what good design and kind of comfortable environments looked like, and those got replicated time and time again, and they're kind of enduring, the endless way is what he used to call it, the endless way of building.
Right.
But there were these patterns that showed, that popped up all the time. So things like seating, people always knew to pick particular places for public seating, and they have certain qualities and characteristics about where those seatings, where a good place for seating shows up.
I want to talk about the seats on Bow Street.
It sounds like you're getting carried away in detail, not pattern.
Well, no, because the pattern, it's repeated, so it's a pattern. Could I use that excuse? What it is the seating here on Bow Street was designed by someone looking at a 2D plan and like, okay, we're going to have a garden here, we have a tree here and here and here, and so then we'll put a little bit of gardeny bit around it rather than paving, and we'll do that with a little curve here, and we need some seats, so we'll do the seats around the curve, and the seats force you to turn your back on the people you're sitting next to. It's a bad pattern for a seat.
Well, that's exactly right. And so I think there is an interesting distinction, too, about where we gain our pattern from.
Yes.
Are we making it up or enforcing it based on something in our heads, or is it something we're observing from either the natural world or enduring settlements? You know, are these new and novel ideas that we're trying to test, or are they drawn from some other source of inspiration?
It's like some industrial value system, I think, was in the head of the person designing it, and it's not a very good design. You can have fully absorbed all the industrial value systems and still do a good seat if you're a good designer, because you think a little more deeply about it.
That's right.
This was a pretty superficial thinking.
Well, and I think that's it. So the pattern there is
default pattern.
Yeah, and it's probably based on values like replicability, durability. And again, you can take those same values and you can use a more rigorous process to, I think, arrive at a much better arrangement.
Yeah, I don't think a rigorous process was used.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, a detail, but yeah. Do we want to come back? Well, actually, you've probably got stuff you just want to get into, do you?
Well, no, that's okay. I mean, I'm happy to take the conversation as it comes, but I think this idea of a pattern language is actually quite useful. And again, we don't have to talk about Christopher Alexander, but the idea of, when we start noticing patterns that repeat regularly, and again, not necessarily in the way you're talking about, in terms of a forced pattern, and which we often find in our urbanized kind of industrial landscapes, but more patterns that show up in either natural systems or in more traditional systems, because culture generally has a way of encoding the things that work and forgetting the things that don't, if that kind of makes sense. Or if the mistakes are big enough, then it will also encode those, but basically as a red flag to say, let's not do this again.
I feel like our modern culture is not doing that, though.
It's not doing it. I would agree with that.
Yeah, because the next thing that popped into my head was the way they used to design schools was all these classrooms were put in military rows, and there was no creation of a common space or a feeling of protection around you or anything like that. It was just the military value came out in the designer's hands.
So I think this is a really good example, is thinking about this, like our modern education system is, whether we like it or not, has been based on essentially has emerged out of things like the factory and wars, and you know, so there has been the design of it is questionable. And so, you know, for example, a pattern language, I guess, is some of the work of Robin Dunbar. I don't know if you know the evolutionary evolutionary anthropologist.
So he's not the one, Dunbar's number, is that where that comes
exactly
from?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Okay. Yep, Dunbar's number. So so originally his work was based on looking at the I think it's the frontal cortex, or the some of the more the parts of the mammalian, and I think more specifically the primate brain, that are able to process large sets of information, and looked at the relationship between the size of that and the population size of different types of primates. Okay. Anyway, and he arrived at a bit of a kind of an insight there. But then through that, he started to look at, and then he did some kind of almost like back of the napkin calculations. And he thought, well, based on the work that I've done and what I think I've figured out, is human societies probably the optimal is probably about 150 people. And that's for two reasons. One is because of the cognitive limits of the human brain to be able to recognize in kind of quite meaningful ways the difference between different individuals, and maintain information about, you know, that number of individuals. And then the other side of it is even more pragmatic, I think, around just the amount of time we have to maintain and cultivate meaningful relationship.
Yeah.
And so his assumption, the Dunbar number, is 150, and it's approximate, but you can... And then other people and himself have done a whole bunch of other research, and they found that actually 150 is about the maximum that of kind of quote-unquote, you know, true friends, or, you know, kind of community that you can maintain meaningful ties with.
Yeah, and I remember someone describing it like anyone who's outside that, like the person who delivers the mail, obviously a human being, but our brain files them as the thing that does the mail.
So this is, again, about more intimate... meaningful relationships that we can sustain through our lives.
And I think this is where I get in trouble with the show, because I sit here and have a reasonably intimate, I don't want to use that word incorrectly, but a conversation, right? And then, and for the person who's come in, they feel like they've got to know me, and I've got to know them, but then I haven't, next day I've got two more people in the chair, and a month later I've forgotten who I talked to that month, you know?
Yeah.
And I always feel, I'm sure I walk, apologies to everyone out there who I've interviewed and walked down the street and not recognized you a few months later, like... But so that's my brain not coping with that.
It is. This is the Dunbar number. So it's, again, there's a limit. So what this research suggests is there is a physical limit.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are exceptions, but not many on average.
And I'm clearly not one.
You know, somewhere between 120 and 160 people is the amount that the human brain, through evolutionary processes, has been able to recognize and sustain meaningful relationships with. And the interesting thing for me about that is, you know, in and of itself, that's kind of an interesting fact. But then humans over time have structured our societies to reflect that. So, you know, traditional Indian villages, traditional English villages, you know, all around the world, we're finding evidence that about somewhere between 120 and 160 is the typical village size for human populations through, you know, a lot of human history.
And then they might go and form another tribe.
And so, like, if I understand it right, is people like the Amish or the Mennonites, once they get to larger than about 160, they consciously split. They almost have these protocols in place to go, we're too large to sustain ourselves as a single community. We need to split now.
That's an interesting thing just for, like, churches. Like, I'm just thinking of Christian churches in New Zealand. And
and
some of them have absorbed the modern culture of bigger is better.
Mm.
And the more people you get, the better you're doing.
Yep.
But in actual fact, for a church community to feel like a real community, well, it's still going to feel, I don't want to use that word real, I shouldn't use that, but obviously there's advantages to keeping that number around 150.
Well, and again, depends on the intention
and
the
any other club too, like your sports club or anything like that.
Well, so I think it even goes further than that, because it suggests settlement size, right?
Well, we've blown that here in Raglan, haven't we?
But and then it has implications around, you know, school size. Even our geopolitical system is the number of people at which can meaningfully make decisions about matters that pertain to them directly. So the implications of some of these insights are potentially quite significant, and again, quite in conflict.
Can you also apply it to Parliament itself so that we've got 120 MPs?
Yep.
We should keep that number pretty much where it is and not get like in the UK, the Parliament there has like hundreds and hundreds. And a lot of the MPs are just kind of forgotten about.
Yeah, that seems right to me. But again,
Parliament as a village is an interesting idea.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
But the interesting thing for me about that too is that's the total amount of people on average that an individual human can maintain ties with. So the implications of that is for them to represent a constituency in their local population, to have their own immediate community, their friendship circle and all of that, and then on top of that, maintain meaningful relationships with an additional 119 people is a bit of a stretch.
Yes, of course, you can't. Yeah, you can't be part of multiple 150s.
That's right. So it's not that. It's like for every individual community I'm part of, there's 150. No, the evidence seems reasonably compelling that the total number of people that I can maintain ties with. And my friend the other day, I was saying something like, "Oh, I had a dear friend of mine pass a couple weeks back, Poihaere Morris. She was a bit of a legend in Kuia in the permaculture community, and I went to her tangi and I was kind of lamenting to my friend that I didn't spend more time with her. You know, it felt in the moment as I was kind of grieving all these excuses that I had for not going to Whakatane to spend more time with her, and my friend just kind of went, the Dunbar number is kind of fixed, you know, don't give yourself a hard time for not being able to not extend that number, you know. There's a real limit to our ability to maintain, you know, like I'm part of a global village. I have loved ones all around the world. But the reality is that I live where I live, and most of my time and effort goes into that.
I know, and reflecting on Parliament, the reality is that each MP is kind of, they'll have the connection. Most of their caucus will be part of their Dunbar number, maybe.
Yeah.
But certainly the people in the other parties won't be, and hence the tribalism that we get in Parliament. Mm. And so Parliament maybe should be no more than 40 MPs. I'm on the spot. Like, if it's 40 MPs, then they all will actually know each other and not see each other as enemies. I don't know.
This is maybe a controversial thing.
I'm being idealist.
Say,
I'm being idealistic.
If we start with the pattern, I think we need to rethink our governance. Full stop.
Yeah. And are we getting off topic at this point in time?
Well, again, I think we're still generally talking about pattern to detail. But what I will say there is, if people are really interested in this idea of designing from pattern to detail, using ecological principles to design our geopolitical system, there's a man named William Offals who's done some amazing work in this space. And Sane Polity is the best consideration, the best treatment I know of someone actually trying to look at a pattern language for
governance.
For governance.
And that's what I'm trying to do here, which is dumb because I've got no... I need to read more before I start doing this on the fly.
But I think where you're starting, your starting point is, let's look at the existing system and see how we can retrofit it.
Yeah.
And this principle is about, I would argue that that's almost like a detail to pattern. Because we have this existing pattern, and what we do need to do is we need to reevaluate that pattern and go, is actually does that make sense to govern ourselves that way?
Yeah.
Based on how the world actually works. And I'm not sure, and again, this is a controversial thing I think to say, but I don't think that representative democracy is particularly effective. You know, I think it has been in the past.
It has its flaws. Everyone would agree with that.
And what was that Churchill quote? Is, you know, it's the worst system except for every other one.
Yeah. Can we come back with the pattern thing? I think I'm interested in your own property. Like, just for concrete examples, what patterns have you, aside from the fact that all that land would tend toward a forest, given the chance?
Mm-hmm.
What other sort of patterns are you picking up that you need to take note of before you start working on it?
Yes. So I guess patterns that more generally I'm aware of, and then I know how they play on my site, is, for example, things like water movement. So I know how water moves through the landscape. And so the pattern there is your low-lying bits are wetter than your ridges. And so I'm designing for that. And part of that is about consideration of species, so more drought-hardy species on the ridge lines and more wet-loving stuff in the gullies,
yeah.
You know, simple stuff like that.
Yeah.
But then also, how do you start hydrating or bringing water to those drier areas. And so you can use your lower areas in your kind of your catchments. You can catch water there, and then you can divert it to areas of your landscape that might otherwise dry out. And that becomes increasingly important as, you know, we start moving into more volatile or more unpredictable weather patterns.
So you're not being a purist about the pattern and saying, oh, well, that's where dry plants go. Like, you are manipulating it to a degree.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm trying to... Yeah, absolutely. So again, I'm designing from the pattern. And the pattern is, you know, there are areas of my site that are vulnerable to drought, and there are areas of my site that are vulnerable to flooding.
Yeah.
Yep. So then what I do with that information is I guess, the next step to that.
And I guess another pattern, too, is something like if you strip all the vegetation from the land, the topsoil will wash down the the hill.
Exactly.
And that's... no permaculturist needs to be... think about that consciously, because that's, you know, one of the most basic things.
But so it's really simple things like so knowing about contour and the pattern of sedimentation, so small particles getting washed out in rain events. So even just simple things like, you know, and you could test this, is taking some you know, leaf litter is probably harder to tell, but something like wood chip, and putting wood chip, you know, a small mound of wood chip on contour around a sloping bit of your site, and just watch what happens over a year. You know, that's part of that pattern recognition and identifying how much small particles are going to wash down and then get trapped into that. So you can actually build up these kind of buns. You can kind of terrace naturally by just using small or even putting logs on contour and noticing what happens and how much soil accumulates above that log. So again, there's really simple ways in which we can design from pattern to detail. And that's, again, understanding about, you know, just basic physics, that water moves through the path of least resistance.
What about when you go to put the house on? Like, how does that interact with the pattern?
Yeah, so that's interesting. So from a pattern language, Christopher Alexander point of view, this is counterintuitive, I think, for most maybe Westerners. But what an enduring pattern of successful settlements over long periods of time is, you put buildings in your most compromised, least beautiful places, and then you work with the natural beauty that's around them. We seem to have a pattern or a practice of going, where's the most desirable, most beautiful place? Not necessarily desirable, where's the most beautiful place? Let's put the house there, and then we'll kind of force everything around it.
That's funny, because I come down Bow Street and I look across the harbour, across the inlet to the other side, and you see like one or two houses there, and you think, oh, that'd be a choice place to live over there. Mm. And then when you go over there, you're looking at Raglan, you're like, no, all I can see is houses.
Yeah.
It's actually better to be here with all the houses, looking at the bush across the harbour.
Mm.
Yeah.
So, and that's a big part of it, is how do you create the most optimal kind of living environments, and I say living quite loosely, is you maintain or enhance the natural beauty that's already there, and then you use the edges or the more marginal areas for your house sites or your building sites, and then you find ways of tying those buildings into that natural beauty, as opposed to the other way around, which is what we typically do, right? And so, like, there are things in the RMA that try to address that, so, you know, like natural character. So you might need to do what's called a LVA. Is it a land visual assessment? But basically making sure that your house is not an eyesore on the local landscape. It's not quite the same thing, but there's an element of that.
Yeah,
but it's interesting how through time and across cultures, there's a practice of going, oh, this space here is a bit funny. Let's put the building here.
Yeah.
And when you compare that to what we normally do now, which goes, oh, this place is beautiful. This is gorgeous here. Let's put the building here. And then often you kind of ruin a lot of the natural beauty. Or at least you impact it in a negative way.
Yeah.
That didn't quite answer your question, but that's part of the answer. I guess another one is, you're thinking about from that design from pattern to detail. Before you even get to your buildings, there's a lot of other features that you want to be thinking about. So you're thinking about typically water is almost, you know, one of your primary considerations. Another one is access and circulation. So how do you move around and through your site?
Yeah.
And then things like, you know, topography, soils, steep erodible slopes, things that you need to protect and mitigate against.
Yeah.
Then those become another layer. And then out of that larger pattern, then areas for for things like buildings fall out of that.
Yeah.
So, and I...
They become apparent, I guess.
Yeah, so I went to the permaculture, the National Permaculture Hui just this past weekend, and that was down in Taranaki at the Green School. And, well, it's quite a funky environment. You can definitely tell that that was a landscape-led project. You know, the buildings don't have any direct... They don't talk at all to the landscape. They're not nested within that site at all. It's the other way around. And then they've done this quite extensive landscape plan. They've planted lots of trees to, I think, over the next 10 years, make it look like the buildings belong.
Yeah.
And so you notice it when you see it.
Yeah, it's what we do.
Stuff stands out and you go, ooh, that's a bit kind of jarring. And over time, again, you can landscape so that it's less jarring. But you know, I feel like I know when I move into an environment where I go, wow, this was designed with the landscape in mind. And it was a landscape-led design. It was an ecology-led design. Then the buildings and the structures fit into that place, if that makes sense. They're not imposed on that place, but they actually sit within the landscape in a really functional way. And you still might be able to notice them, but they don't jump out. You know, whereas I think a lot of modernist architecture is all about, well, I'm going to pay someone extra money to make my house site like stand out so that it looks, you know, it has a castle-like quality to it.
Yeah, you're opening a can of worms there, man.
I'm just saying, so yeah. This idea of design from
all these ideas
detail,
are coming to my head about what happens with the way we design in the modern world. It's, I think we want our house to, is what we're responding to is social.
Yeah, factors, absolutely.
Social factors, including status, rather than physical factors.
I would agree with that. Yeah. And, you know, size of house sites, and there's a whole range of reasons why that is. But from an ecological and a more traditional culture and society point of view, how humans, there seems to be a pattern language. Humans over time have recognized that how to get really good outcomes is by applying, you know, what we might now call, you know, universal pattern languages. But at the time, I think they just, it was through trial and error. They tried different stuff and they go, actually, you know, this doesn't work. Oh, if we do it this way, it works better.
So there's, we need to wrap up, but there is very little in our urban environment in this modern world that fits, that would have been done that way.
There are examples. So I think, you know, often, and they're not always done well, but things like village greens, you know, these common spaces, these gathering spaces that we can use to congregate. And again, in more traditional societies, they were, because again, they had hundreds and hundreds of years to test this stuff out and learn too, right? So without giving ourselves too hard of a time, is I imagine that over time, we're going to have to relearn again how to create effective settlement design. And again, you know, this isn't all about just settlements, but we spent a lot of our time talking about settlements and buildings. But over time, I think our eye for good design will evolve and become more nuanced and more sophisticated and lead to better outcomes for the people who are using those spaces.
Yeah, well, we've had in the last 100 years a whole lot of tools arrived.
Tools and energy. So we've been able to force, you know, we've been able to do things dumb in a way that our ancestors would kind of just go, oh my gosh, you can't waste all of that energy and all that resource. And we've gone, oh, no, we can. We've got lots of it.
It's not a problem.
So I think that's part of it too is, you know, relatively speaking, more traditional cultures were a lot more frugal because they had to be.
Yeah, yeah. But they also had a long time. They've also all made their mistakes and learned from them.
That's right.
And we maybe haven't got through that yet.
Yep, agreed.
Yeah. All right, Finn, thank you for coming in this morning. Yep. And we'll talk to you again in a few weeks. Folks, we'll be talking to Finn McAsey, who is a permaculture man, available for hire if you're local.
You got this real plug around invest in local. I love it.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't my plan this morning, but I finished off the Karigo Project interview with a message for merch, pushing the merch.
So, Christmas merch.
Yeah, Christmas merch, help fund the Karigo Project get some Christmas presents at the same time. Do you have vouchers?
I don't.
You don't have vouchers?
Sure, I could arrange something.
Maybe for Christmas. Yeah, for Christmas, some vouchers with Finn would be the way. Yeah, we'll work on that off the air, folks. I'll get back to you. Yeah, thanks for coming in.